You are listening to This Podcast Could Have Been an Email, presented by Berkshire Community College.
Welcome, everybody, to our fifth edition of This Podcast Could Have Been an Email. Jonah, how are you today?
I'm okay. I'm doing okay, I think. How are you? How are you, Adam?
I'm well. I'm very excited because we have a really wonderful guest today, and one of my dear friends, Matt Mueller, who's the Dean of Humanities, Behavioral and Social Sciences. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited. So, Matt, we asked you to be on our podcast because of the book that you published recently, First Aid for Choking Victims. And I wanted to start out by asking you, we know each other pretty well. We've run marathon together. Why are you so sad?
You know, it's...
I've been like prepping for this question since we came up with this concept for this podcast.
Yeah.
I've read Matt's stuff for years now, and I've like always wanted to get him in front of a group of people and ask him why he's so sad. You seem so happy.
I was not prepared for that question. I feel like I should have been. Like, I have a similar question, I think. I didn't know that Adam was going to articulate it so well. So good luck, Matt.
Yeah, you know, my brother joked that the book was really not a lot of first aid, but a lot of choking victims, which I thought was a pretty good line. You know, it's funny. I don't know that I necessarily thought of this book as a sad book until I started like hearing from people, and I was like, oh, I guess maybe it is pretty sad. I guess most of the characters they're kind of like outcasts or loners or weirdos or some sort of version of that, and I guess that comes with a certain level of sadness. It's weird. I do think that probably in public I come across as a pretty like positive person, but I've always kind of thought of myself as a melancholic. And I think I've always thought of my writing as being like kind of what I really think and feel. And so I guess, yeah, I don't know, I'm just kind of
I'm curious about that last thing that you said about how you really think and feel. And I think a lot of artists use their art to get out into the world things that otherwise they wouldn't have an outlet for.
Yeah,
and I'm curious if that resonates with you.
I don't know if it's an outlet for me so much as, I guess I like to think that when I sit down to write something, I'm trying to uncover some sort of a truth or some sort of a fully developed reality. And I think because this is sort of my first attempt at a book of short stories, a book of fiction, it's probably a little bit more self-involved than maybe some of my later work or more recent work that I've been doing. And so it comes across maybe as a little bit more personal. And I don't know. There's kind of like a trope about writers that like typically early career, they write a lot about themselves and it's more biographical. And kind of the longer they keep writing, it tends to kind of look outward and be more invested with, trying to represent other people and ideas. And while my book isn't really necessarily about me, I think that there's some of that there probably.
I think one of the things as I read the book, I happened to know your brothers and your parents, and you're probably fortunate because your parents are both artists and you wrote a book with your dad a few years ago. But, as I read the stories and I thought about like, hi, Mom. What's that like? I've never done that. I haven't put myself out there the way that you have. And how do you kind of interact with the people who you're closest with? And I think there's a certain level of kind of being this incredibly vulnerable in terms of the way that you think and approach things.
You mean like how are they reacting to what they're reading?
Yeah, and how do you interact with that reaction?
And I guess just to piggyback off of that, because I have this similar question, is the sense of, is there a fear of giving away too much about yourself through your writing to people who are then going to have to
live with you after you reveal too much about yourself? And what are those interactions like afterward? And does that hinder or does that elevate your writing when you're in the process? Because it's very scary.
And maybe the relationships too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that part is really hard. And you know, when I was writing more memoir, like the first book that Adam mentioned, you know, that one's kind of tricky because you're writing about people in your life. And even though, you know, even though you're kind of trying to, you know, I guess something is told from your perspective. And so it's still sort of biased and whatever. You're still trying to get a truth across. And sometimes that truth, you know, can be seen as hurtful or I don't know. So yeah, you have to be really careful and you have to try to get things right. I think, though, most people go to art because they want a real experience. So, like, I think if you're going to sit down and read a memoir, you don't really want someone who's going to sugarcoat things. You don't want someone who's going to, like, varnish the truth. You really want something that feels real and raw and personal. And so you just kind of have to go for it and then sort of hope that people are going to be cool with it.
Matt, I think this would actually be a really good time to hear you read. But we've got about 2 minutes before the break.
Okay. I will read from a... it's always hard to choose what to read. So maybe here I'll read from the longest story in the book. This is called I Want You to Tell Me. And it kind of... it's like in the middle of the book, more or less, and it takes, I think it's about close to 80 pages. So this follows a college student in her sophomore year. Her name is Sasha. And this is her walking home from class right before spring break when she has to go home to visit her boyfriend's parents, which she's not really looking forward to. So I'll just read a little bit from her walk home. On her walk home, she stopped for an iced coffee at a shop in the basement of an old brownstone. She sipped it as she thought about the class, about what the professor had said, about the truth. The sun was slanting down in long, bright staves of light over the edges of buildings as cars rushing from light to light passed her. She let the class filter through her thoughts and let it run out over her life, which suddenly seemed small and predictable. She was just a college student with a boyfriend and a major going back to a small apartment, just as any professor might predict. She was no one to take seriously, just a sophomore handing in her little papers for marks, and as so often happened on these walks home, her life started to dissolve around her, as if it were paint oozing from the walls, revealing a nothingness behind them. She was a black silhouette proceeding through a world of white outlines. She tried to bring the world back. She was walking outside in the city, and she loved to walk outside in the city. She was drinking her coffee, cold and sharp and sweet. The ice sloshed around in the clear plastic cup. The condensation was cold on her fingers. The world rose. She had a solid boyfriend. She was taking classes. It fell again, dissolved. She was surrounded by a buzzing kind of white static.
Thanks so much, Matt. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in after about a 30-second message.
Yep.
Starting on Friday, May 2nd, with her opening night at 7 p.m. in the Robert Boland Theater, don't miss the BCC Players production of Lucky Stiff, a musical farce in which a British shoe salesman inherits $6 million from a dead uncle. There's only one catch. To get the money, he has to take the dead body, prop it in a wheelchair, and take it on one last spree to Monte Carlo. This show runs for 2 weekends. Get your tickets and support our students, faculty, staff, and community by going to berkshirecc.edu/BCCPlayers.
And we're back. Matt, thanks so much for reading that section of your story. And I think it's an experience that probably anyone who's grown up, it's, you know, coming of age kind of experience and thinking about the world and your place in it. I was particularly struck by the line about her being a black silhouette surrounded by white outline. Care to kind of, I don't know if you can put yourself in the place when you wrote that, but as you think about it and read that particular image now, what does it mean to you?
Well, I went to school in Boston, so I think part of writing the story was just fun because it was taking me back to what that was like. I went to Emerson College. And this character, Sasha, I think is probably one of one of my favorite characters, if not my favorite character in the book. She thinks of herself as an artist. She takes herself very seriously. She wants to be the best ever. She wants to be taken seriously, as you can tell from from that section. And yet there's like this kind of persistent sense of like meaninglessness that will take over, meaninglessness. And she has kind of a hard time holding on to just sort of like the solid everyday reality of life and being okay with that. And so a lot of the story is kind of about that. Like, her boyfriend is a pretty solid, practical person. And she's always like thinking about things in terms of like, what is the literary significance of this experience? You know,
kind of lives in the esoteric.
Yeah. And, you know, in some ways, I think as a reader, she can be very frustrating. You're like, oh my God, stop. You know, which is like the part I really liked. And then on the other hand, you know, I think she's someone who's, you know, also really kind of struggling with something. And I think it's difficult for her to figure out, you know, why her life matters or why any life matters. And so that's sort of at the heart of the story.
So one of the things that I thought about a lot in preparation for this conversation is you individually made the move, which I'm sure is a really difficult decision to make. I made a similar one, though. I come from a student affairs background. You come from an academic affairs background, to leave the classroom and to join administration. And I think it's this particular passage is poignant because it reflects not only the decisions that we make about who we are and finding meaning in our own lives and our own work, but we're in a particular profession where every day we come to work to do that for the students that have given us the gift of their time and to find their path. And it'd be interesting to hear you kind of think about the transition in your own work and profession and how being an artist and an author maybe informs the way that you approach your current practice.
Yeah, I think I realized in college that I wanted to be a professor because I saw my professors in action, and I saw how, like, in a creative writing workshop, they got to every single week talk about new stories from new students, and they got to, you know, teach stories from established writers. And that seemed to me like a really rich life. You know, you're meeting new artists who are young and aspiring, and you're able to have really interesting conversations. So for me, that was kind of like the North Star in my professional life for a long time, was to try to, you know, be in a classroom and be with students and have the richness of that experience. Now, as a dean, obviously I'm not in front of students as much. And so that's been a, you know, a pretty big shift. What it has meant for my writing, though, is a lot of the creative energy that I put into planning classes and thinking through how to present material, I, in some ways now, I've actually been able to put toward my writing. So when I'm good and disciplined, I'll wake up at 5 and I'll write for an hour or so.
Wow.
And then, you know, I can kind of transition to like email brain.
Wow.
So, and then I've been lucky too. I started a PhD program this year, so I've been taking one class each semester, and we'll probably be doing that for like the next 5 years. But that's allowed me to kind of come back into the classroom as a student, which has been a really fun experience. And also I think is helping me in my role, because I'm so aware of what the student experience is now. And of course it's different for me going back to school as a 40-year-old, but, you know, I think we have a lot of people who come back to school as non-traditional students here. So
yeah, it helps you kind of get, build empathy for the students that you serve. You know, it's interesting because Jonah's a writer too, and both of you, I think, have you know, found yourself in administration, and you have this creative outlet. And I'm Jonah. I'm kind of curious about your process as a writer as well. And I'll just own the fact I don't really have a creative outlet. And I was thinking as I was listening to you talk, Matt, I guess I've always thought personally one of the things that where I draw from my pool is developing other people. Yeah. And when I was a direct service person, I came to work every day and I worked directly with students, and that's what I was doing. I get very little student interaction in this job. So I think I get it more maybe now from working with the really great team of professionals that I work with every day. But I, again, Joan, I'm kind of curious about your process as an administrator and how you tap into creativity?
Well, that's actually a really good question because I feel like I don't have time to be creative. And very similar to what Matt was saying about, I feel like when you're giving yourself to others to help them become better, you might not have the capacity to then find that in yourself to be able to develop some of the things that you kind of want to say or need to say. I've always had a story in me since I was 13 years old, and I've known how to tell it. I knew what it was going to be. I knew how it was going to be. I just didn't know how I was going to get there. So I eventually did. I just sat down and I just wrote it all out. And then we're in year two of still editing it. Luckily, we have some talented people who are helping with that process. But if I didn't get that story out, I felt like I would be a disservice to the people in my life who I owed that story to. And so that's what I really needed to do. I'm very family oriented, and this is a story about my family. So I needed to get that out, I think. And if I didn't, I feel like I would have felt at a loss. But when it comes to being an administrator, I find that you do have, the creativity comes from like collaborations, I think. I really feel like I always have imposter syndrome in every single thing that I do. I think a lot of people do, and they just prefer to admit it. And so when we actually, everything clicks and everything makes sense and we're getting somewhere, I'm like, okay, this is finally working. And I think, I look forward to having the space and time to be more. But you're right. If you're giving so much of yourself to others, I feel like it's hard to take that time for yourself. And like, I heard that when you were talking about the teaching role and how important that is. I got to be an adjunct for a heartbeat, and it was one of the best moments of my career. I didn't ever expect it to be so much fun. And you just get so connected. But at the same time, you know, I'm really excited for those students, but you do ask yourself, like, when do I find time for what I need to do? So.
Yes.
I mean, it's an interesting, just listening to both of you, you know, the waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you don't mind waking up early, right?
I would say I'm not a morning person by choice, but I have learned to really love it. And there's something really nice about it like still being dark and it's quiet and you have, you know, an hour or so just to, you know, be by yourself and do your own thing.
Yeah.
It was interesting is I heard Nell talk recently, Nell McCabe, who's an English faculty here. I heard her talk recently about her writing process. And I think she framed herself as a morning person. Now she woke up with energy and had a lot of energy to write. And then as that kind of fizzled out, maybe she would agree with you in the, all right, now I have to shift to email brain.
Right.
I do wonder though, I mean, this is like a really interesting kind of topic. Like as a person who works in higher education, at a community college that isn't as well resourced as some other institutions, you have to give a lot of yourself. And how do you kind of find, as Jonah framed it, time for yourself? Or I always have this like vision in my mind of a pool, and when it's full, when that cup is filled, then you have the capacity to kind of give that to other people. But when it's empty, you've lost it. And I don't know, what advice do you have to people? I'm guessing, like Jonah, lots of people come to you once you publish something to share their own creative outlets. What advice do you give to other people? I mean, you're a pretty successful guy. You've become a dean. You've published a book. You've got a lot of good things going on.
Before you answer, we're going to take a quick break.
Thanks, Jonah.
BCC is lucky to be hosting the first Berkshire State of Work Summit on Wednesday, June 18th on campus from 8 a.m. to 4. This event is billed as a conference that will look at From Hiring to Thriving, a New Era of Workplace Culture. People are saying that they're wicked excited for J.D. Chesloff, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Business Roundtable, to be the conference keynote speaker. We're expecting over 200 Berkshire County-based employers to attend, and it's all being done by our incredible Workforce and Community Education Department. Learn more at berkshirecc.edu/worksummit.
Thank you and welcome back. We had ended the last segment with a question to Matt Mueller about, you know, Matt's, I was complimenting you. You're a successful guy. You've done really well. You published a book. You're a dean here. I'm sure that there are a lot of professionals here who admire you and wonder how do you accomplish all of the things that you're doing? And what advice might you give to someone, not necessarily who wants to go into administration, but who's looking to take on new challenges and advance in their own idea of what advancement is in their professional career?
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking actually about the advice that writers often give, and usually the advice that writers give is advice that has worked for them. So like my first piece of advice would be like, you know, don't take anybody else's advice. You have to kind of figure out what works for you. I think what has worked for me is that in terms of my writing, it's been kind of the one constant thing in my life that has felt like something I had to do, wanted to do, and loved doing. And so I really make time for it. And in making time for it, I make choices that then exclude other things. So sometimes I will choose to write instead of, you know, seeing friends, or I'll choose to write instead of going on a hike with my partner, or, you know, or I have to, you know, postpone that, or whatever it is. So you can't, I don't think that there's like a version of life where you can have like, you know, a big group of friends, you know, a busy job, rich social life, family, all that stuff. I don't have kids, and so that also just really helps. I, you know, I have a dog.
You have no idea how much. No, I'm just kidding.
But I think that makes a big difference, right? I often think about, like, on my weekends, I can have a slow Saturday morning, and I can spend a couple hours, you know, writing or doing homework or working on a project. So that's, you know, that's a big part of it.
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I heard you just say is, I think you love it, and yeah. It is one of the things that helps to refill my metaphor of the cup. And I think we talk about this a lot now in our work, where there's this real drive to align educational outcomes to workforce outcomes. And I think my opinion is many students choose to go to college because they're looking for economic mobility. And I think that's a fact. But I think that often manifests itself in what is the quickest way to the highest paying job that I can get.
Right.
And forgetting about this, what do I love to do? And what's going to keep me working, and choosing my work over other things that I enjoy doing. And I think that this is a real argument for more traditional liberal arts programs and majors. I think over time, there's evidence that people who get degrees in the liberal arts make good money. But I think that sometimes our students come in and they think, I need to go into a position that's going to quickly have a financial outcome for me. And I think that the trap in that is, if you don't love it, you're not going to want to go back to the work. And one of the things I thought I heard you say in that is, part of what makes you successful is it's not that hard for you to choose writing over hanging out with a group of friends.
Right. I hope none of my friends listen.
I'd rather be. I can't remember the last time we hung out, to be honest. Who else wants to come on this podcast?
I think that there's definitely truth to it. I think too, you know, it's hard in fields like education, because you're often asked to do things because you're passionate about them, and you're passionate about your community, and you're passionate about your students, for not a lot of money. And, you know, kind of the model right now, if you're a young educator and you're starting out, is that you work as an adjunct, as a, you know, part-time instructor for a bunch of years to build up your resume, and you teach at a bunch of different schools. And then if you're lucky, you end up getting, you know, a good full-time job. And then kind of the expectation is that you have to hustle for a while. For me, that always felt worth it, because I loved going to class, and I had a good situation with, you know, working other jobs, like, you know, painting houses or whatever it was. I also think that, you know, we live in a county that is really rich in the arts. And yeah. So this is also an industry where, you know, you can look around and you can see, oh, there's all these arts organizations, and they also employ people. And
yeah.
So I think we're kind of lucky in that. And then I think, you know, anywhere you go where there is a sort of a robust tourist economy, the arts tend to be a big part of that. So I think it is important to remember that. And I think, you know, thinking about the liberal arts just in general as a, I don't know, a way to live your life is really rich and really important, and, you know, really helps build communities.
There are these like little scenes in movies that stick with you for your entire life. And one for me is always in Dead Poets Society, when Robin Williams has this soliloquy about how going into medicine and business, these are noble professions, but poetry, art, music, this is the reason to live.
Yeah.
I didn't quote that exactly right.
It was very good though. Yeah, I got chills.
Yeah, my mom went back to school, 30 years after getting her RN, and she went to the Elms, and she was taking a BSN through BMC as a nurse, and so she's taking all these classes, and they're nursing classes, obviously, to help, save lives. My sister's in the same boat, my brother's in the same boat. My mom's favorite class, though, was a philosophy class. It was the class about the train, the track.
Yeah.
She loved it. She was like, it was the most fun I've ever had learning. And because previously she was learning, but she was learning like what to do to stop someone from bleeding to death, right? Like it's super important, but it was much more stress inducing than the opportunity to really engage in a mindful conversation. She loved it.
And if you really love moral philosophy in that particular philosophical question, The Good Place is a really good comic to watch.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah.
Well, I think that's also, that speaks to why we have, a general education curriculum.
Right.
And that you can go and you can, you can learn about how to put on a tourniquet, but you also then take a philosophy class that, enriches your life.
Yeah. And I think that these experiences in these classes also help us understand one another. I think we're in this moment nationally where you can't really have conversation and debate if people are so grounded where they are. And I think one of the things, I'm very drawn to fiction. One of the things that fiction allows you to do is to step outside of your own reality and struggle with some of the enduring debates that we have as humans, but do it outside of yourself. And I think that there's some escapism, but it allows you to struggle with real world issues outside of yourself and your own experience.
Yeah, I think that's the power of fiction. For me, it's an incredible mix of being, fiction can be political, fiction can be philosophical, it can be spiritual. It also helps you to understand other people and live through them, and then you can have these deep emotional experiences. So for me, it's always been this incredible mix of a variety of different disciplines that I really like coming together in one form, and I think that's what has continued to draw me back to it.
All right, we're going to take a pause right there and we're going to come back for our closing segment. Be right back.
Do me a favor. When you're done driving, please head to berkshirecc.edu/commencement and check out all of the incredible end of year activities the college is hosting. There are PTK ceremonies, pinnings, dance parties, concerts, art shows, and more. Come out and support your students, faculty, and friends by showing up to as many of these events as you can, culminating in commencement, which takes place at Tanglewood on May 30th. Showing up is what matters, so give it a go, and let's make Fetch happen together.
Welcome back. I want to thank Matt Mueller for being the fifth guest on our podcast. This has been really fun, Matt. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the advice that you've given to our faculty and staff, and it's been... I'm sorry if we came at you a little too hard. I thought this was going to be light and breezy.
Be light and breezy.
We are hard hitting.
Yeah, we really are.
I think it would be great if you could leave us with a little bit more reading. And Jonah actually made a request. So this is a requested passage that Matt is going to read to us.
Thank you so much. It was really fun to be here. Thank you for having me on. And I actually really appreciated the hard hitting questions. So I will end with Jonah's request. This is from a story called Hank. And Hank has this kind of deep shame in the center of his life, which is that he never learned how to swim. And he feels like he should be able to swim. He lives in a place with many lakes. And he has recently met a woman who has invited him up to her lake house. And so he's driving up there to see her. And of course, there's going to be the expectation that he goes into the lake. So here's a little passage. From that. As he drove, the presence from the mountain followed along up there in the sky above him, floated and circled, rushed through the treetops. Somewhere in the back of his mind, his little fantasy hung on, and he thought he just might out and tell her, though he couldn't quite conceive of the moment. Could he really just lean in and say it casually? I cannot. But the words wouldn't come. He couldn't finish. He imagined the various reactions she might have. First, laughing at him. What, you? I don't believe it, Mr. Man. No way. What? You can go into a forest and cut down all those big trees, but you can't swim? The idea would continue to make her laugh as though he was joking with her, and he would shrink under her derision. Or she might just see it. She might just say, oh, that's okay, honey. let's just get you in the water and then give it a shot. But that would almost be worse, her talking down to him like that, using the word honey, and everything he'd have to give up in that moment. He just couldn't imagine it. The roads turned to long, snaking switchbacks as the country got higher. The towns were smaller, and a kind of grayness came into them. This grayness was more acute, more tense, the taut grayness of being alone in mostly unpopulated places, where the land and the mountains and the trees that covered it all were bigger than the people. Small towns with square storefronts and flat roofs came and went like choked breath.
Very powerful. Thank you, Matt. And for listeners, the mountain that's behind you and the swimming issue that you have in your own life, we wish you the best of luck. We wish that you face your fears and that, like Matt, you put yourself out there and take the next leap. Appreciate you listening to our podcast. This podcast could have been an email. As always, if you're interested in joining us or want to recommend a colleague, Jonah and I are more than happy to have you. Thanks again, Matt. Really appreciate it. Jonah, as always.
Yeah, thank you so much. And everyone, we'll see you on the other side.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Could have been an email. We want to thank the incredible Adam Klepetar for making this show happen and Matthew Mueller for being an amazing guest for today's show. As always, we want to thank Dave Cachet at PCTV for sharing our good works on all of your podcast streaming platforms. And we want to thank you, dear listener, for continuing to support this Wee BCC show. If you're interested in being a guest on our show, just shoot us an email or side tackle us in the hall. We are always looking for guests to tell their story about why BCC is the best place there is. My name is Jonah Sykes, and thank you for listening.